May it please the court. I'm Rob Shanis, and I represent Landform Professional Services.
One moment.
Oh,
sorry. We just have a few introductory items in the Marshall, go ahead.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Wheelock, Judge Reyes, Judge Jessen, the Honorable Sarah I. Wheelock presiding.
Okay, good morning, everyone, and welcome back to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is Thursday, June 23rd, or yes, I think I'm right, June 23rd, yes, 2022. We have six cases on the calendar today. Three are scheduled for oral argument, and we've already heard two arguments in person in courtroom 200 here at the Minnesota Judicial Center. We now have one final argument to hear via Zoom.gov. As stated, my name is Sarah Wheelock. I'm the presiding judge this morning, and we are on a panel with Judges Lucinda Jessen and Peter Reyes. We are hearing this argument, as I stated, via Zoom.gov. So before we begin in this virtual format, I just wanted to note that oral arguments are recorded by the court. The audio recordings of the arguments are generally available on the court's website within 24 hours. And also, our appellate rules prohibit anyone from making an audio or video recording of oral argument unless you have received the court's permission at least 24 hours in advance and have agreed to comply with specific conditions that have been set by the Minnesota Supreme Court. And with that, Marshall, will you call this final case for oral argument before us this morning?
This is case number A220274. Landform Professional Services, LLC, Appellant versus Kevin Lefebvre et al. Respondents, the Bank of Elk River et al. Defendants.
And counsel, as you probably know, each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Counsel for appellant, you will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. There is a clock in the square on your screen. It should be in the upper left-hand corner. And so please pay attention to that. That will count down your time for argument. I also ask each counsel to please introduce yourself and identify the party you're representing at the beginning of your argument. Please mute yourself, but leave your video on when you are not making argument. And finally, if anyone has any difficulties with technology today at all, please stop us and we will try and help and assist you with resolving that because we want to ensure that we are able to hear from everyone here today. So with that, counsel for appellant, please begin when you are ready.
Sure, thank you. May it please the court, I'm Rob Shanis and I represent Landform Professional Services, the appellant. In this case, the district court determined that there were no disputed issues of fact concerning whether Landform was obligated to give a pre-lien notice. The district court reached its conclusion by expressly disregarding facts that, when viewed in the light most favorable to Landform, should have precluded summary judgment. After reviewing the facts de novo, this court should reverse and remand. The facts relevant to this appeal are fairly straightforward. The Lefebvres entered into a contract with an entity called WH Diversified to sell it their property. The WH Diversified is a land developer. There's no indication that it had ever had any intention to actually perform any construction work on the property. WH Diversified in turn hired Landform to perform surveying and civil engineering work. Landform ultimately submitted documents to the city of Otsego for approval.
Counsel, if I could stop you there, I think we're familiar with the facts and the record. I guess I have one key question, and that is, what is the precise date that Landform started working on the project?
So when we say working on the project, I'm going to presume, Your Honor, means performing actual civil engineering or surveying work that would be lienable. And if that's the case, then the precise date is sometime after the 1st of January, 2019. The record doesn't reflect the precise date, but the second declaration of Darren Lazan makes clear that it's after that date, which puts it squarely after December 21st, the date when WH Diversified became an equitable owner of the property.
So there is no precise date that is in the record?
there's no precise date in the record when it started performing work.
Okay. And so in that second affidavit, which the district court basically said was a sham affidavit, that said that it work on the project began after December 21st, 2018.
Yeah, the second affidavit or declaration said that it was after that date. I believe there's another paragraph in there that talked about it being performed starting in January 2019, the actual work. I think it's worth noting that there's nothing inconsistent here. The first declaration said on or shortly after December 18th. The second one clarified it after. The Lefebvres, for the first time in their reply brief, made the argument that WH Diversified was not, in fact, an equitable owner on December 18th. So the
It does seem to be in direct conflict, because the first declaration said that the work began, quote, on or around December 18th. And the second declaration says that the work did not begin on the project until, quote, after December 21st, 2018. I don't see how we can square those two statements together. The first one, or the second one, second declaration seems to directly contradict the first one of saying on or around December 18th, especially if you're now stating that the work began in January. That's clearly not on or around December 18th.
Well, I suppose that depends on an interpretation of what or around means. And it doesn't say it started on December 18th. It says on or around. The fact is, it's an imprecise statement. Now, when you talk about a direct conflict, the second declaration does not simply say, nope, it didn't happen on December 18th. It provides considerable amount of clarification as to precisely what the work was.
It seems to muddy the waters up more, because it says after December 21st, but it doesn't say when after December 21st. And that seems directly contrary to on or around December 18th. And that on or around does include on December 18th.
Well, it's an or. Around. Yeah. I understand what Your Honor is saying. And I think perhaps, when there's a vagary like this, there's a couple questions to be asked, which is really these. One is, assuming that that a conflict existed, then what does that make it, the second declaration, a sham affidavit? Okay, that's the first question. The second question is there enough in the first declaration as it stands to create a disputed issue of fact? And the third issue really is, keeping in mind that the Lefebvres argument is that the first date of work is not the date relevant for determining when pre-lien notice must be given, but rather the date when a contract was entered into between Landform and WH Diversified. That argument that the Lefebvres make is supported by the statute. The statute specifically says that the determination is to be made, look for the language, both subdivision one and two rely on, it says every person who enters into a contract with an owner is obligated to give a pre-lien notice. It goes on to say that. Obviously, there's no pre-lien notice requirement if you are contract with an owner and hire no subcontractors. So the other thing I'll say is the Minnesota Supreme Court, subsequent courts have been really clear that the sham affidavit rule applies when there's a conflict between deposition testimony and a subsequent affidavit. You can't sit for...
Go ahead.
So for a moment, let's set aside the sham affidavit doctrine. And can you point us to any Minnesota case law where, I mean, what I see here is it's like a party's, let me restate this, where summary judgment is defeated because a party effectively is creating a material disputed fact with itself. Because without going to that doctrine, how do you create a factual dispute with yourself and then preclude summary judgment? Any case law to help us there?
There is case law. There's two cases that we cite, and I can call them up in a minute, but there's two cases. There's the Hoover decision and the Schmidt v. Harlan decision that I'll direct you to. In Hoover, a deponent testified that, in fact, they did not maintain documents in compliance with state and federal law. And later, they came back and said in an affidavit, no, we did actually maintain records in compliance with state and federal law. I now had the chance to review my documents. And the court said, you know what? That's not a sham affidavit. That's clarificatory and permitted. In Schmidt v. Harlan, which is truly on point here, in a legal malpractice action, an affiant in testimony said, this is the date something happened. This is the date when I received this advice from my lawyer, and subsequently changed the date, entirely changed the date by a month based on, the case isn't clear what he changed it based on, but based on information, I believe information he received about when a judgment was issued by the court. So in both instances, I think that directly addresses your question, Judge Jessen. I mean, there is case law that says that when it's clarificatory, as it is in this case, it's not directly conflicting. I think that the emphasis that I'll make here is we go out of our way not to grant summary judgment when there's the potential for disputed issues of fact. This is not a case where Landform is creating the fact dispute. This is a case where Landform clarified the facts in a subsequent declaration, and the district court decided to ignore that subsequent declaration. And clarificatory information is not the basis for a sham affidavit. If Landform had simply said, gotcha, nope, the data I gave is wrong, with no information to support it, then I could understand having a problem with that. But Landform
is saying, what is the information then that's clarifying? Because it's saying that it was sometime after December 21st, but it doesn't say when. How is that clarifying the date?
Well, I don't think there's...
Because really, the dates here are important.
Sure, but what's important, Judge Reyes, is that the date, assuming that the work commencement date is the relevant date, what's important here is that Landform commenced work on or after December 21st. It doesn't matter what date it was, as long as Landform's commencement of work was after WH Diversified became an equitable owner. And while I can understand the court's desire for a more specific date, I think it's worth remembering that this motion was brought before discovery was completed. It was brought before any depositions were taken.
But this is not a situation where all that is relevant, because this is information that Landform has. And Landform included this information in its complaint. It included in its mechanics lien statement that the work began on the project on or around December 18th, both in the complaints and mechanics lien statement, and from the work order and from its own records. And I think that's why the district court said, wait a minute, you've got all of this information, all these claims by Landform that specifically point to on or around December 18th as being the date that the work began. And then at the 11th hour, you've got this affidavit saying, oh, no, it wasn't on around December 18th. It was after December 21st, which is conveniently the date that the parties entered into the agreement.
Well, in the second declaration, Mr. Lazan explains that, though, which is what he says, is that, he's a lay individual who filled out a mechanics lien statement. The time records have the tasks performed from December 18th to the 21st. Are described in his declaration as being administrative tasks, drafting the contract, doing a little research to determine what the scope of the work is.
But he may be a layperson, but he's filing an affidavit and swearing under oath in the first affidavit that the work began on or around December 18th. This isn't just a off-the-cuff statement. That's after supposedly they're doing their due diligence to find out this information to provide it in his affidavit, which is included in the complaint and the mechanics lien statement, and is also found in the work order.
Judge Reyes, I guess I have to respectfully disagree as to whether on or around is sufficiently specific to be a directly conflicting statement. I understand that it's in the initial declaration. Also in the initial declaration is a paragraph saying at the time that Landford entered into work order number one, it was aware that WH Diversified had entered into a purchase agreement to purchase the property. So you've got that statement. In addition, you've got on the contract front, which I believe is the correct way to look at this, you've got a work order dated December 18th. You've got language in the work order saying it doesn't become effective until there's authority to do the work. You've got it signed on February 19th. And all of this information is also in the first declaration. So if you're going to make a judgment about the date something occurred, that is a facts question. There's no argument that it's not a fact question. And the question is, what you've identified is certainly ambiguities in Mr. Lazon's declaration. We have trials every day where witnesses are impeached based on what are perceived to be contradictory statements that they've made. What we're talking about is whether you grant summary judgment based on non-ambiguous statements where no deposition was taken. If this court were to grant, were to uphold the district court's decision, it would be an absolute outlier in doing so where there's no sworn deposition testimony. It would be creating essentially... Well,
but there's other case law. There's the Hagen v. Stephen Scott management case where it was found to be a self-serving affidavit that contradicted an employment offer. You've got the Samper case looked at affidavits as well, the Rysdell case. So I don't think it would be an outlier at all.
Oh, there's several unpublished decisions, and I'm aware of only one published decision, which is the Rysdell decision. And that involved parties attesting that they did not intend something. So subjective intent, which conflicted with the actual documentary evidence. In every case, the recitation of the rule is that you can't have a conflict with deposition testimony. And the controlling Minnesota Supreme Court precedent is very clear that that's the rule. So, you know, we've cited a number of cases consistently relying on the conflict between deposition testimony and other testimonial statements. Are very few, if I'm only aware of a single published decision that says that documentary non-testimonial evidence can conflict, and that's a reason to call it a sham affidavit. At the very least, it would be contrary to the majority of decisions that the courts have issued.
Thank you, Mr. Shanes.
I see that my time is up.
Yes, your time is up. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal, and we will turn to counsel for respondent now. The clock is being reset, and you may begin when you are ready.
Well, good morning, Your Honors. Rick Layton as counsel for the respondents, Kevin and Benita Lefebvre. Their last name is pronounced Lefebvre. And I stand before you representing that or submitting to you that this case can be upheld in two different directions, primarily under the Sether case, the C.W. Clark Lumber versus Sether case, without regard whether or not there is in fact a contract with an owner or equitable owner. You can put that aside for purposes of applying the Sether case directly to the facts in this case, which are unique and support both the dismissal of the case on a de novo basis pursuant to Sether. And secondly, we can uphold the decision by the trial court by the simple arguments that she got it correctly. Judge McLaughlin got it correctly when she determined that there was not a contract. I mean, there was a contract entered to with WH Diversified at the time, it did not yet hold a an equitable ownership interest on the property. Let me first, just by first focusing on Sether, if you'll allow me to, because what Sether has held essentially is that when you are a contractor or a developer, and in this case, which is a business person who's in, solely in the purpose of developing land, that would be WH Diversified, for purposes of evaluating whether or not notice is required under 514.011, you need to evaluate it from the standpoint of them as a developer, as a contractor, as they did it in Sether, not as in under contract with an equitable owner of the property. You don't get to suddenly hide as behind the equitable ownership defense to this situation by declaring that they were just contracting with an equitable owner. And under those circumstances, we have WH Diversified, under the facts, was under contract hiring the appellant in this case under not just this particular property, but under several projects as disclosed in the record through the Hennepin court action that was a part of the summary judgment process. We do in fact have evidence that appellant was a subcontractor of WH Diversified. Under those circumstances, 514.011 subdivision 2 requires them to have given notice to all owners. And for that purpose, I have laid it out several times throughout the brief, so bear with me for having told you what I told you and told you I told you so. I have basically pointed out that Kevin Lefebvre owned 35 acres of the 24 that were being sold to WH Diversified. So we have a general ownership of undivided property that was in fact to be subdivided only in order to close on the property. That had yet to occur, and it has never occurred. It never did occur because the contract was never fulfilled. But it's in accordance with this posture of the case that we have essentially a duty under Sether to in fact, you know, give notice to, at a minimum, Kevin Lefebvre. And just entering into a work order, which they did on December 18th, and contrary to the argument of the appellant, it was in fact carrying terms to it that allowed it to be enforced as a separate contract, not for the commencement of lienable services, but for a contract to be formed just by allowing Landform to proceed, which under the facts of the case, we have Landform admitting in the record that they did.
Counsel, I think you went on mute.
Mr. Layden?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I hope I didn't go too long there without being heard. I simply was saying that the contract formation was in fact by way of just starting the work order on December 18th. We have evidence of administrative services commenced right off the bat. And so we have ourselves a contract formation. That's a separate issue from this issue being raised by appellant that it had to be the commencement of amenable services. Because what they're arguing is that they entered into a contract with an equitable owner. And therefore on December 18th, it was in fact excused of any kind of or whether it's December 18th or any date, they're saying they're excused from any notice requirement. And we're just submitting that Sether contradicts all of that. It would not allow the very same arguments I submit to the court. The very same arguments were raised in the Sether case that you'll find being used now as a defense in this case.
So counsel, let's assume for the sake of argument that they did enter into an agreement with the equitable owner. Can you focus more on your second argument, which is basically that, if I understood it correctly, that the district court got it right in its decision?
Well, let me, if I may, Your Honor, the first point under Sether is that you don't get to look at it from the standpoint of equitable ownership. You have to look at it from the standpoint that they're a contractor hiring a subcontractor. So they do have to provide the notice. and they have to give it the notice the settler holds to all owners that are known to the subcontractor, which we have evidence by a clear admission that they knew of Kevin Lefebvre and his ownership, and the fact they're hired to perform engineering services on only 24 of the 35 total acres. First of all, back to your point, Your Honor, we have ourselves under what the trial court has done is that she's laid out all the facts that I'm now supporting, and plugging into Sether in terms of knowledge of the ownership, knowing that you have more than one owner to deal with. It's not an equitable owner of the entire property. It's an undivided section, but we have Kevin Lefebvre clearly had a greater interest than the one you're contracting with. So that is essentially why there is, in fact, even if there is an equitable owner involved, you aren't required to give notice to both at a minimum, but you sure can't leave out Kevin Lefebvre. So what we have then also is that we have the Dolder case versus Griffin supports all of this. And it even distinguishes itself in its own holdings. It specifically cited Sether, upheld it, said you have to give notice to all owners, but then went on to say it doesn't require that the landform, if it were in the Dolder situation, landform wouldn't have to constantly look up to see who's the new owner if there was any further transfers of the property. That's what Dolder provides. It doesn't provide a contradiction of Sether. In fact, it upholds it. When we get into the measuring of a contract formation, what we heard is arguments from the appellant, and it's in their briefing as well. They're mischaracterizing what we're saying. We're saying essentially their first argument in defense is to say, when we're constantly seeing December 18th repeated four times as a proposition, that's the date, and that's the one we moved for summary judgment on. What we have is a defense that says, well, we entered into a contract with an equitable owner. But so that's the issue of when you entered into the contract with the equitable owner, not when you first performed lienable services. So those two distinctions, I mean, that's a distinction that has to be considered applicable only to that defense of equitable owner. So the trial court got it correct by simply saying, here's a work order that says, by its own terms in boilerplate below the signature, it says it can be either countersigned or allowed to proceed. So that landform was allowed to proceed and they automatically opened the file, started their administrative services and getting ready for performing services. The fact that it happened after December 18th is purely irrelevant to the points that are being made on their defense of an argument. And then when we get into the issue of whether there's a sham declaration or not here, or a sham affidavit, I believe that we've properly briefed for you the point that you cannot argue or those cases as far as allowed to or create a fact dispute, because Judge Justin just said it perfectly. We have ourselves a scenario where you're arguing with yourself. You're just throwing, and that's what the trial court ruled and properly characterized, is that they were dodging for, I calculated a total of five times, they've changed their story. First with December 18th, they talked in terms of having an agency relationship. We bring a motion for summary judgment. They argue nothing of the kind as far as agency. They now talk about that they entered into a contract with an equitable owner. Then they go ahead and even at that time said that December 18th was the date. And then they turn around once we start saying, no, that's not what you did. We argued all these facts that apply to Sether, but we also pointed out at that time that you weren't even, the WH Diversified wasn't yet an equitable owner of any kind. So those are the stories that keep changing, and now they're running from it by trying to throw in something they claim is just only a clarification, but there was actually no clarity whatsoever, as Judge Reyes, you pointed out. And then based on that conclusion, and I have one further point I wanted to make, if I could. We have this argument that there were two work orders in the briefing. There's only one contract number. there's only one mechanics lien statement that was filed for the full amount of a whopping amount of money that's over $300,000 plus, it's quite a significant sum, not any attempt to break it out. And then they go ahead and they essentially under that work order is a basis for a separate action in Hennepin County for a breach of contract. We have ourselves essentially one contract, not two. The fact that there are two work orders, the second one never signed, is not going to create a separate basis for a lienable claim. There's also an argument that under 51406, there was a requirement that my clients as respondents should have followed the provisions of 51406. And my only point to you, your honors, is that it's totally irrelevant. It's even admitted to in the summary judgment briefing by appellant. The appellant has pointed out that it only has to do with actions that can be taken by the respondents as owners of the property, but it does not relieve and has no pertinence to whether or not, in this case, Landform followed its duty under 514.011 subdivision 2 to give a pre-lien notice. And there's a case cited in the summary judgment briefing of J. Rue Design versus Backus, 2005, Westlaw 44907. That is, in fact, the case that says it's irrelevant to the issue of the duty under 514.011. And that concludes my argument. I thank the court for its time here today.
So, Mr. Lane, I do have a just clarifying question is, the record reflects that WH Diversified did have an equitable ownership of 24 acres in the property as of December 21st, 2018, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, because you were citing the Dolder case, and I think that supports that. So really then the issue is when Landform began its lienable work, if they had it, if they did that before December 21st or after December 21st.
If it's
the affidavits is, so that is why the affidavits are so critical as to which ones are.
Only, Your Honor, only in the event that you consider the 33 acres extra ownership or whatever the number still held by Kevin Lefebvre did not require a notice. When you have essentially only 24 of the 35 being developed or owned by or having an interest by WH Diversified. That whole argument of whether or not the dates are correct and when was a equitable interest, our first position is that under Reyes, it doesn't matter. I mean, under the Souther case, it doesn't matter.
To the extent. Yeah, it's not my case, though.
Huh?
It's not my case.
All right, I apologize.
That's okay.
So you end up with Souther is really controlling, regardless of when there was an equitable interest. And so that's our primary position here today. Our fallback position to your point is we feel that the sham affidavit was merely an attempt to create this ambiguity for purposes of defeating summary judgment, when in fact it is proper, based on the cases we've cited to the court in our response brief in this matter. We've pointed out that those are matters of contested, conflicting opinions between parties. This is just a self-inflicted wound.
Thank you, Mr. Layton. And we will turn back to counsel for appellant for the last word. You will have 5 minutes. And once the clock is ready, you can begin when you are ready.
Thank you. I'll first address the idea that the Souther case is dispositive. That case addresses whether or not pre-lien notice is required to be given to equitable owners, really third tier buyers. And the rule articulated there is confined to that. In fact, when Dolder was subsequently came out and it cites the Souther, it cites it for that narrow rule that it applies to notice to equitable owners. The facts of that case are where a legal owner entered into a contract for deed, selling property to a contractor who in turn entered into a construction contract with a buyer. The the contractor failed to pay a subcontractor and then issued a fraudulent mechanics lien waiver at the closing, indicating that the subcontractor had been paid in full. When the subcontractor was not in fact paid, he brought a mechanics lien foreclosure. And at that time, the third tier buyers were the owners of the property. So the question in this case has to do with whether the legal owners at the time that the work was done were to get notice. That question is answered by the NASF decision, which is the Minnesota Supreme Court decision, holding that a contractor who contracts with lessees doesn't have to give notice to the landlord. In that case, contractor contracted with the lessees, landlord knew about the work, and emphasis in that case is put on 514.06, which draws the critical distinction. A fee owner at the time that the work is done has the ability to provide notice that the work is not done at their behest. And if they do that, their interest in the property cannot be lien. In this case, the Lefebvres didn't do that. They knew of the work and they didn't give a 514.06 notice to Landform. And this is a critical distinction because the protection afforded to fee owners, as articulated in NASF, doesn't exist for equitable owners in the position of the buyers in the Sether case. They have no protection. And there's quite a bit in the Sether case about fairness. The court talks about that these are all innocent parties. And so it's clear why those cases are distinct and why Sether doesn't apply and NASF does. But the other thing to note is that the argument really being made is that because WH Diversified is a developer, Landform is a subcontractor under Sether and therefore needed to give pre-lien notice. And the problem with that is twofold. One, the facts in Sether clearly articulate that what made the contractor a contractor is, and I'll quote, that he construct the building on its land and then convey the land and the building to the vendees. That's what changed its status to a general contractor. WH Diversified didn't construct anything. The other point I'll make is that it's very clear that whether someone has the status of a contractor or a subcontractor is a question of fact to be resolved by the finder of fact. And that issue has not been resolved. So even if this court were to conclude that Sether is a controlling decision, it still needs to remand for that finding. I think one thing important that Mr. Layton pointed out is that I think we both agree that the time on which a pre-lien notice is to be determined is when a contract is formed. That's what the statute says. And on that point, there's very little conflicting testimony. The work order said a contract is performed, and Lefebvres concede this, when a direction was given to start performing work. And that direction couldn't have been given before WH Diversified was an owner. You can't direct someone to perform work on property that you don't own. In wrapping up, I think it's we err on the side of giving people their day in court. An error in a declaration that's subsequently clarified is not the basis to grant summary judgment. This is a very slippery slope in this case. If you were to uphold the district court's decision based on the perception that there's a conflict in declarations, even when more clarificatory information is given, and where there's no deposition, I think you're entering into a slippery slope that calls into question how one gets their day in court and whether mistakes made by a party eviscerate that right.
Thank you, Mr. Shana. So thank you to both counsel and to the parties for the arguments today. This has been very helpful. And we will take the matter under advisement and issue an opinion within the statutory frame. And that ends today's oral calendar. The court is in recess. Thank you.
Thank you all.